is a very important issue, and that is essentially, again, the Rav doesn't announce it this way because it's his style, you know, is so integrated into the, you know, I guess into the, you know, the Shir HaShirim, I guess, experience, and, you know, it can get very discursive and it can go off in tangents. But really, this next section that we started discussing is a statement about the relationship between religion and science, which is a very crucial topic, and one which you know, we would really want insight into. So just labeling that alone is just a very important, you know, a very important thing to do. Again, there's a lot of talk here, but we started reading it last time about the relationship between, you know, mathematical precision and formulas and physics, you know, and the correlation between, you know, physical properties and formulae on the one hand and the experience of the real world. But, and all that is very, you know, fascinating, and it's well worth reading in its own right. But it's just important to get a little bit of perspective, and what this is really, really about, again, is the question of different domains. The Rav was somebody who definitely admired, you know, all, you know, disciplines, all rigorous disciplines of thought. You know, he wasn't a mathematician, he wasn't a physicist, you know, but he was clearly, like, enamored, you know, with the precision and the developments, you know, in those fields. Like, he chose as his hobby, I guess, or his, you know, correlate discipline philosophy, so clearly he enjoyed and admired that, or felt it was going to be useful, or probably some combination of all three. But that aside, again, just if you read through, you know, just the en passant, the Agav Orcha comments that he makes, you know, it's clear that he, you know, his unquenchable thirst for knowledge and so on, which is, I think, not just an intellectual pursuit, but really what we're reading in these words is part of, you know, Bikashta Misham itself, a pursuit of the Ribbono Shel Olam through the world, as we'll see in a moment, he so describes it, you know, led him to admire, to be interested. And again, it's interesting to note, and we'll talk more about this in a couple of minutes, that in Mado Dech Midod and in Isha Halacha and in several other, again, very curt references, you know, he compares, you know, the thing that he admires most in the world, which is the world of Halacha, to an a priori system that, you know, is, you know, like abstract or theoretical physics or mathematics. So obviously he had great admiration. You know, he was intrigued by these disciplines, and he had great admiration for them, and also for the advances in them. And he was also very intellectually honest, because there are impressive, you know, areas in which man has made important contributions, and which have contributed to our better understanding of the world, and our capacity to invent, you know, and to bring progress to the world, etc. So it's fascinating, though, that given his background in this admiration, never mind acquaintance, that it becomes a very crucial thing to put it in context, like, what is the relationship between science and religion? So instead of addressing that question frontally, you know, he's kind of doing it by, you know, through the back door, by discussing, you know, man's search for the Ribbono Shel Olam in the world and in nature. So what you have is a very strong statement about the qualitative inadequacy of this otherwise much admired science and philosophy and math, right, to address religious issues, or even taking, you know, step away from religion, existential issues, issues having to do with the quality of life, you know, and the things that man, you know, in the recesses of his mind and his heart and his soul, you know, is really concerned, you know, and troubled by. And basically, that's why it's so important for him to kind of endorse a more modern, you know, the more modern acknowledgement that there are limitations, you know, to these to these other disciplines. And this is very consistent with things that he does elsewhere. I'll just read the lines here very quickly, and I'll tell you what I think is a big leitmotif in his general thinking. But again, what we finished off 2 weeks ago, last time we met, we're talking about even philosophers acknowledging that you know, their limitations. Even mathematicians do not deny this fact. As I'm on page, page 9 of the translation. Even in the field of science, the divine mystery remains in place. Even in the field of scientific knowledge, it cannot transcend its own limits and escape the circle of categorical assumptions corresponding to critical scientific experience, which is limited to the domain of finite perception and thought. Science does, however, admit to the presence of an irrational element in any worldview and does not deny the right of others to investigate it. Were one to ask, what is the irrationality hovering over the pure scientific conception, the answer would be that it is in the realm of the qualitative and the sensory. Modern physics, which has given such great prominence to the symbolic character of scientific constructions, knows it cannot provide satisfactory explanations for one who aspires to penetrate the innerness and essence of being. And the qualitative reality, as we experience it, there is no relativity, there's no quantitative reciprocity, nor are there mathematical equations. I'm skipping a little bit. Tones and colors encompass us completely, oppress us with the burden of its otherness, amaze us with their size and force, remains unexplained by science. Aristotelian physics attempted to explain, and this is a very important piece of it, Aristotelian physics attempted to explain reality through its true essence and its experienced qualities, but it failed and misled people for many centuries because it led them to believe sincerely in the possibility of intellectual enlightenment about qualitative being. Both classical and modern physics have abandoned this daring enterprise. The creators of modern science are aware of the irrational character of the world. The deeper truth that has been revealed to them is that they must give up the vain attempts of the ancients to understand the essence of phenomena and concentrate instead on creating abstract constructions composed of mathematical formulas corresponding to concrete objects. So basically, I'll read one more paragraph. Quantitative correlatives of this type, whose entire meaning is not intrinsic within themselves but lies only in the mutual relations, have become the objects of scientific inquiry. According to modern scientific philosophical view, experience and theoretical inquiry belong to different realms. Experience belongs to the realm of actual living, concreteness, theoretical inquiry to the realm of formal abstraction. There's a correspondence, but one cannot speak of identity. The philosophical background of the scientific endeavor is the faith in a mysterious correspondence, and indeed experience has not, I'm just jumping a little bit, has not disappointed this scientific faith. But quantitative mathematical explanations, although they have immense technological consequences, do not provide answers to the greatest of man's questions. What is the nature of meaning? What is the value of reality? From Schelling, Kierkegaard, Bergson, Husserl, and other masters of existentialist philosophy and modern metaphysics, humanist thought has continued to rebel against the scientific symbolic a priori approach and has refused to recognize it as a solution to its bewilderment. Right? The cry bursting from the soul, longing for infinity, breaks through a contemporary philosophical thought, rebelling against the formal cognition of creative reason as a response to the soul's greatest questions. So basically, what he's suggesting is that while medievalists were of the opinion that there was no line or no division or there was blurred lines between, let's say, science and philosophy and religion, right, that in a way, this is kind of ironic, and he elaborates a little bit more lately, the more modern like view on all of these things is that they are separate domains. What's ironic, of course, is that the impulse in many cases for that division or that acknowledgement of a dichotomy was an abandonment of spirituality and religion.
Right. It's like modern, like basically modern science / modern philosophy. Modern philosophy is devoid.
Modern philosophy, in some respects, is even abandoned, big questions entirely. I'll just go back a minute. But in the end of the day, what Rav's really suggesting is that has kind of liberated religion, and these bigger questions from being shackled to the limitations, of rationality or the advances of science. So the motivation might have been ironic. He doesn't bring this point out so much, although he definitely is saying that. The motivation may have been, very, the consequences may be unintended and even opposite of the motivation, but the result is, and I think, we see this, we see this a lot. In the introduction to, or the beginning, I should say, of Lonely Man of Faith, so he starts Lonely Man of Faith by, a little confessional, I guess, saying that issues of, for our purposes, the conflicts of religion and science, seem to be all the rage, in the 50s, 40s, and the 50s, and the 60s, right, that they never really troubled him. He never lost any sleep. He said, I never have been overly, disturbed, by these questions. Which questions? The questions of, the age of the world and evolution, all these questions. He said, the things that I lose sleep over, the things that trouble me, the things that I want to address, the things that I pour my energies and immerse myself into, are the so-called existential, questions, the question of loneliness, the questions of man's purpose, and so on and so forth. So that's an interesting comment. People have asked me about it a lot, over the years. Like, what did he mean by that? Was he dismissing that those are, issues? Like, you're saying, they're silly questions, they're not important? Did the Rav have some, answers in his pocket, for these, questions that have trouble, and that's why he went through the sleep over? I think the answer is neither of those. I think it's exactly what he said. Meaning, Rav was, again, a very incredibly intellectually honest person. He was an incredibly inquisitive person. Surely he, was not denying that these are questions, that we don't have good answers to these questions. I don't think he spent any time working on them. It wasn't the area of his, the kind of gifts that he had were not to figure out, the dating problems or what happened to dinosaur fossils, or it just wasn't his. People thought, Rav probably had an answer to that. It's very, cute but that wasn't his, area. I think if you would ask him about it, he would say, those are questions. And if you were asking, do you have, some special solution, I think he'd tell you no. What he meant was, I don't lose sleep over those questions. I have enough faith that, there are answers to those questions. These discrepancies somehow are neutralized. They're factual dilemmas, they're historical questions, they're scientific questions, but what matters to an Isha Halacha, to an Isha Das, or to a man of faith, is the question of, what am I supposed to be investing in, why is my existence meaningful, and what is my relationship with Kadosh Baruch Hu. So he wasn't dismissing them, but he was saying they belong to a different domain. In exactly the same way that here in Bikashta Nisham, he's saying, I admire math, I admire, physics, I'm at my insertion. The thing that I admire the most, is benefits from, the comparison and the model and the framework, and in the end of the day, it's still important to know that unlike the medieval perspective, which all of that is the same, now, these are totally different domains, and all of this, there's correspondence, but there isn't, identity between them. And therefore, these are not the questions that bother them. The Rav in, we'll see in a second, he makes reference, going forward, first by implication, and then he mentions Kant, although not fully, in what I'm about to talk about, but, the Kantian critique of proofs for the existence of God, right? Immanuel Kant, one of his important contributions was that he argued that, the assumption of these philosophical demonstrations was an accessible divine being that is measured, on the basis of human you know, categories and considerations. And that by definition, that should not be the case. So Kant argued that in theory, right, there should, the notion of demonstrations of proofs for the existence of God was philosophically insignificant. Because the nature of what God is already establishes the inability to access him through regular philosophical categories. So again, typically, Kant is perceived, you know, as having attacked, let's say, and from a certain perspective he did. If you talk about, you know, the medieval Jewish philosophical enterprise, or Psagigon, Chotzavavos, the Rambam, you know, and so on and so forth. So Kant, he wasn't attacking them, he was attacking Aristotle and Plato and, you know, tens of others. You know, I wouldn't think about the Rambam and Albo or Crassus, but at the end of the day, you know, Kant's insight, which was mostly accepted by the world of philosophy, again, and which also led very far in terms of you know, what philosophy ended up being, which you were kind of alluding to before, which is you know, a different discussion, positivism and things like that. But you know, Kant is often seen as something that devastated, like a pillar of halakhic or Jewish belief. And I think the Rav's view is that, you know, the opposite is true. That, you know, it kind of liberated.
Yeah, that's like the Rav's line, that response that there we mentioned before, fits very nicely with that. For sure, a distilled Kantian view.
Right. He likes a Kantian view.
Yeah, yeah.
Because it doesn't reduce.
Because it's just like the it's
religion.
That's,
you know,
that's the easiest way to separate the two.
To science and philosophy. Totally. And there's no, Kant didn't say that. Kant wasn't arguing against the existence of God. He was just saying that it's not demonstrable according to human reason, by definition, partly because of the inadequacy of human capacity and the you know, unattainability of divinity.
Right.
So that's a very important, so like in L'Holy Man of Faith, for example, the Rav approvingly quotes Kierkegaard's you know, kind of ridicule of Anselm, one of the Christian philosopher, Saint Anselm. So he was like, you know, he writes in his, I guess, confessionals that he spent, I don't remember, months or years, whatever, is praying to the Ribbono Shel Olam, didn't say the Ribbono Shel Olam, you know, so that his proofs for the, you know, that his proof, you know, will be, you know, accurate and will be accepted, you know, by the philosophical world. So Kierkegaard, you know, a little bit unfairly, but, you know, in a great, you know, couple of lines, like, you know, really, you know, lambasted, you know, somebody said, the guy, what, you know, how absurd is that? And, you know, what is it, days, months, or years, whatever it was, in tefillah, you know, to the Ribbono Shel Olam.
It's antithetical to the definition of philosophy, also, to say such a thing.
Right, and so what he was saying was, this is what Kierkegaard basically said, does one need, I forget the exact language, pick up your Kierkegaard, or you're quoting Kierkegaard, but something like, does one need, in the embrace of one's beloved, you know, does one need demonstrations, you know, of their existence, or something like that? So, like, how absurd is it that he's davening, you know, so he'll be able, but the truth is a little unfair, meaning, you know, to be fair to Anselm, you know, what he would have said to you was, I'm a believer, I'm a man of faith, and I also think it's important to manifest that faith in, you know, Kolatz Mosai Tamar, I don't know if you would call it, you know, the Hebrew, Hashem Michamocha. So, and in his view, you know, at that time, this was an accessible thing. Not to be able to demonstrate the existence of God would have been, you know, would have implied, you know, that the conclusion is false. So it's not like he was identifying his, you know, demonstrative proof with the faith itself. But it's still a good line, and the Rav likes it. And the reason he likes it, I think, is for the reason that he, you know, expresses right here. The truth is, this is really the revolution of the, I think it's the revolution of the Kuzari, or the Yudalevi, the Kuzari, is sometimes perceived as, you know, somebody who is anti-philosophical, an obscurantist. But if you read the Kuzari, you know, it's certainly not true. I mean, he's totally trained in the disciplines of the time, you know, the poetry, the, you know, the science and the philosophy, and he's very comfortable doing philosophy. The Argument of the Kuzari, there's a good, very good book on Buna Lane, by the way, by this guy Simon Halkin, which I think really captures this point. But the Kiddush of the Kuzari, and it was a huge Kiddush for somebody of precisely because he was trained philosophically and he was part of that world, was that the unmoved mover, as he calls it, of Aristotle, right, is maybe something that you could, you know, demonstrate, you know, through proofs of the existence of God, but that doesn't bring you to the, you know, to Elokei Avraham, Elokei Yitzchak, Elokei Yaakov. Essentially, again, but he was a medievalist, so he really deserves a tremendous amount of credit for breaking away, just like the Rambam, you know, turns his back on astrology. That was like revolutionary. But the Kuzari basically was arguing, you know, this argument, not the inadequacy of the proofs of the unmoved mover. He wasn't taking a Kantian approach, but he was saying it's beside the point.
That's right.
And that's kind of what the Rav is saying. And that's where the liberation of one, you know, from
the
other.
Is he saying that's beside the point, or is he just saying that there are limitations to proving it?
No. Kuzari wasn't saying there are limitations. He believed in the medieval enterprise that you could prove the existence of God. He was just saying, in the end of the day, well, what have you proved? You've proved that there's a force that created the world. That's why I emphasize Aristotle's unmoved mover. That's how Aristotle understood God, the unmoved mover. So Kuzari was saying, great, terrific, you proved it, and now what? Because that isn't Elokei Avraham, Elokei Yitzchak, Elokei Yaakov, who's mashgiach on the world and who, you know, imposes upon us a certain lifestyle. Therefore, he basically... He wasn't anti-philosophical. He just thought that philosophy was beside him. He was ahead of the world in this idea, and he was basically saying religion is about, you know, historically the history of the Masorah, the history of and the belief. Yeah.
This is why they say that the Gra said that to learn Kuzari instead of learning like the Shara Yichud of Chalas Halavos was this because of this idea.
I'm guessing. Makes sense. And the Shara Yichud of Chalas Halavos is sometimes not printed. You know, again, it's a...
They're still not there. They don't give the biurim on the bottom.
Oh, really?
They have a lockdown on why not to read it.
It's a great. It's great. You should read it. It's great. But again, it's a typical medieval, you know, experience. But again, Chovas HaVavos, because the rest of it is so much, and that's the point. Like, the whole rest of it is about Chovas HaVavos, right? Meaning the translating, you know, belief into action. Also, this very fascinating shitos about bitachon, you know, and so on and so forth, and yet it starts off in this philosophical way. So, post medievalists, you know, had the it was very jarring for them. You know, they kiyumu thought it's like the implication is, you know, that if you can't prove this, then it just doesn't exist or it's all philosophy. That doesn't fit with the rest of the book, so they took it out. You know, but that was there was nothing in the Chovas HaVavos time or perspective that was consistent with that. So again, the Kuzari, the Kierkegaardian comment, all these things are really about this exact same thing. So we're not talking about double truth theory either, exactly, like the Arabic philosopher. You know, again, a contemporary of the Rambam, Averroes was known to believe in a double truth theory, which meant that the way he solved, you know, a conundrum, you know, about your religion and science was to say, like, you know, that's true, you know, in the world of religion, and that's true in the world of science. That was known as the double truth theory. Okay. And it sounds a lot like double talk. You know, what does that mean? So that's not what the Rav is saying, and that's not what Kant was saying, and it's not even what the Kuzari was saying. Again, the adequacy of the proofs notwithstanding for the Kuzari, you know, what they're saying is that not that there are two truths. You know, you can have a lot of people live like compartmentalized lives. You know, they have this truth and their that truth. Usually, that is not a viable. You know, usually it's called schizophrenia. But the truth is that's not what we're talking about here at all. We're talking about different realms. we're talking about things, two things that exist, but they're not different perspectives. There are different dimensions of the world, not different perspectives. You know, the item perspective again, but it's not not this truth that contradicts that truth. But you can choose your realms. There's no contradiction. It's just different realms essentially. So this is really what he's saying, and then he kind of refers to Kant. We do not deny that there is a certain difference between, I'll stop in one more minute, and present ways of thinking about seeking infinite through finite reality, whereas medieval and early modern philosophy expresses a search for infinity and eternity in objective terms by formulating ostensibly decisive, logically valid proofs. The contemporary perception dares to deny the logical objective validity of these proofs. The contemporary conception, I wrote on my side, this is Kant. Later he mentions Kant, just not in this context. Asserts, this is on page 12, that we have no right to use these categories, which result from a finite contingent temporal existence, to prove truth of an infinite, absolute, eternal reality. The next paragraph. However, while this conception was intended to this, where I think he's making the argument, which is already implicit earlier, that it liberates rather than undermines, he says, however, while this conception was intended to uproot and deny, it found itself implanting and affirming. It denied the possibility of using logical proofs to make indirect inferences from finitude to infinity, from temporality to eternity, from actuality to transcendence, but instead of abolishing these proofs, it accepted them anew as immediate experiences. Right? It shifted the focus to the chavaya datit, to the religious experience. It's totally aboriginal, the beginning, the end of man's reality. It's forever prior to inference or deduction. It's the most certain of all certainties, the truest of truth. If there was a world, this is very beautifully written, this is the experiential perspective, if there was a world, if anything is real, and no one who has not been ensnared by vain sophistries has any doubt about this, then there is a God who is the foundation and the origin of everything that exists. If there is a self, this is a beautiful line and an important one, it's not only in the world, right, that we intuit or experience Rabboni Shalom's existence, but in ourself. If there's a self, if man exists, and this too all human beings know with certainty, then there's a living personal God who fills the consciousness of the self. And he goes on to quote, Eya Asher Eya, that's what it means, and he quotes the Rambam in the beginning of the Sodei Torah, that, the Yisod HaRishon is Tzius Hashem. But he means it, even though the Rambam certainly meant that as a philosophical proof, it talks about Mor Ruchin. There's a whole discussion about Leida and Lahamin. I hope everybody's familiar. The Rambam says Leida in the Arach HaZaka, in the Sefer Torah, and in Sefer Mitzvos. The way that the Ibn Tibbans, at least, should translate is Lahamin. And then Reb Chaim Heller pointed out, Chaim Heller was like the hero of the Rambam, that the Arabic is ambiguous. And it's an Arabic word that means either lahamin or leida. And then my contribution is that the ambiguity is intentional. We wanted it to be lahamin and leida both. But I'm kind of talking about it. But one's just saying one, I would say the other. So the religious sensibility does not offer decisive proofs. It senses and experiences God in its innermost ontological consciousness. Just as someone who sees a tree does not deduce indirectly that there are roots under the ground, for in the very perception of the trunk there's knowledge of the roots. So too, at Ikar, then, of course, the imagery of, Kofar B'Ikar, right, the roots. So too, man has no need to draw conclusions by God, for he knows God directly through the world, according to Pasuk in Yeshaya, right, Se'u Einechem, and so on, Mibara Ela, or the rabbinic statement, right, that Chazal used when he talked about Avraham Avinu, right, that, there cannot be an illuminated castle, right, without an owner, the bira, without an owner or a leader, right? These are not abstract logical proofs, although, and again, in the Medrash they happen to be, but the argument from design, the argument from so on, but they're all saying you could take them without that. On the contrary, they refer to the immediate awareness that overcomes that. Let's finish this off. Moreover, these immediate experiences are dynamic approaches, or more accurately, powerful aspirations. This is where he doesn't quote at all the Kuzari, but I think the parallel is made. What he's saying is, even if there were, proofs of existence of God that were very compelling, even in a modern era, in the end of the day, you know, they don't, they provide you with data, with a fact, but they don't in any way enrich your life, the purpose, infuse the purpose of your life, right, or help you develop a kesher bond with the object of the proof. He doesn't say all this, that's what he's saying. Moreover, these immediate experiences are dynamic approaches, meaning the immediate ones, or more accurately, powerful aspirations. Right? The problematic of reality hints at and winks towards secret of creation, the whisper, beautifully written, that secret within man. The secret cannot be captured by symbolic scientific solutions and cannot be illuminated by the radiance of a creative mind. Only outside of formal symbolic cognition with discrete structures of thought can the secret be revealed. Again, promise at the end. And then he quotes Kant without mentioning the other part of Kant. Kant's teaching, despite all the difficulties that it's encountered, has not been undermined. So I think this is his way of saying, that aspect of Kant. Reason does not photograph the given, but adapts it to its own need. It sculpts the given. The deity is not subject to the intellect of its creatures, and the experience of God, infinity, and eternity is not confined to the particular extent of the finite temporal mind. Yet what is impossible for the serene mind is well within the capacity of the storm-tossed experience and mighty aspiration that results from a direct confrontation between man and a world enveloped in the divine presence. Again, so what he's done is he's shifted the presence of the Shekhinah in the world, right, as the knowing the world is knowing the existence of a Kadosh Baruch Hu in the world. And therefore, again, the study of science and so on, Hashemayim Nisachim Kibbol Kale, not just proof of existence as an extraneous idea, right? It becomes a point of contact, in a way, with the consciousness of the Ribbono Shel Olam, which is another way of saying Hashra'as Hashkina, frankly. Okay? If the experience of God in man's confrontation reality is expressed not by demonstrations based on complexities of the acts of abstraction, but by feeling of the sudden revelation of a direct, unmediated fact within our consciousness of being, then perception of the world itself becomes perception of God, and all the demonstrations resurface in a new form. Right? This, instead of abandoning it, we've like enriched it. Again, he doesn't talk about the Kuzari at all. We've solved the Kuzari problem, essentially. In other words, we've found Elokei Abraham, Elokei Yitzhak, Elokei Yaakov, not just the unmoved mover of Aristotle, and we found it through nature, precisely by acknowledging that science and religion are two realms, and yet, that the qualitative experience of the world, implies certain things.
If that's going to help us for Elokei Abraham,
well, again, these are my phrases. I'm trying to bring the parallel of what I think the Kuzari was. But yes, absolutely. Well, the point he's trying to make is that, like the Anselm, Kierkegaard point that he liked in Lonely Man of Faith, though he doesn't quote that here, is that in the end of the day, if you're left with a rational, dry mathematical, scientific demonstration of Metzias Hashem, very nice, yes, you're mm-hmm. Like, who cares? Okay. What does that do for your quality of life? So you have that piece of knowledge. Mm-hmm. If the piece of knowledge, stands on its own, it's not unimportant, but it's of very limited importance.
Right.
I'm just paralleling that to the comment of the Kuzari. Right. You can prove the unmoved mover of Aristotle.
Right.
But what he's trying to suggest is that, that these other mechanisms provide us not just with knowledge or
also feeling.
But with the feeling which animates our sense of purpose, and which, if we allow it, affects our spirituality. That's what I mean by
Elokei Abraham. In other words, like the Kuzari's, what the Kuzari gains is also context, which you don't have from just the feeling and the meaning.
Not yet, and not alone. And that's why the continuation, which I guess I'll wait for my semester for, is where he's going to explain that science and the world, well, that's only one step. And that the bigger step is Maimon Har Sinai.
Right.
And then he's going to go back and forth, and there's foreshadowing, between Avas Hashem and Yiras Hashem, and two levels of Ava and Yira, and the oscillation between, scientific reality and Dvar Hashem. And so that's where you're going to get fill in the context. I'm just using these other things because I think that is what's going on. So So let me just finish these just a couple more sentences. Then the perception of the world itself becomes a perception of God. This is not pantheism, right? It's this idea of Hashras Hashina, I think. And all the demonstrations resurface in a new form. Even Kant admitted this when he defined the three concepts, God, man, and the world, as regulative ideas. The human bond to God is expressed in aspiration, not in casuistry, like Bill called, in yearning, not in clever logical acrobatics. No, again, we admire clever logical acrobatics and casuistry. And again, they're all himself in these other places, uses physics and mathematics to describe the halakha. But the point is that the Rav's idea of the halakha is this a priori, you know, magnificent structure that you're supposed to approximate into the world. But the point is the implementation in the world is a key aspect of it. And that's where Mice and Mitzvos, I believe, fit in too. Because the Mice and Mitzvos are the ones that give it the qualitative and the richness, the contact with Hashras Hashina. Why does man know no rest of this world? And that, of course, is the story of Shir HaShirim, right? Originally with the back and forth. Why does man know no rest? Why does he seek that which he shall never find? It can only be that God draws man to him. Hashkeni, this is the beginning of the chapter, Acharecha, Merutza, but the failure of his search doesn't prevent him from continuing to seek that which he cannot find. This something gives him no rest. It stimulates his nerves. What is the nature of the search? Nothing but a search for God. In other words, the frustration, the aspiration to find purpose, something that is transcendent in the world, he's suggesting, is a bikashka nisham as Hashem alakam. Whether you know it or you don't know, right? What is the mysterious something that eludes man's grasp each time? It is total attachment to God, the source of all sources. In man's yearning and frustration, God is revealed. That's just a very fascinating shift, right? The world is nothing but the glory emanating from the infinite. Then the rest of C is kind of like a summary of that. We can skip that because, hungry people are fasting on Yom Eidah, right? we'll stop here. But so we'll pick up with chapter 3, I guess, when we come back. That gets back more into the role of Halakha, Avon Yira, other very fascinating things. Okay, so that will pick up with our Halakha.